Hello and welcome to the program. My name is Luke Hunt and with me today again is Ross Milosevic. Ross has worked as a security risk analyst around the region and he's just returned from the border areas Thailand and Myanmar. Ross, welcome to the program.
Yeah, nice to talk to you again, Luke.
I understand that you're kind of up and over the border, which has its own issues, but what did you see up there? Tell us what you saw.
Luke, I saw a lot, and it was very disturbing indeed what I saw and what I heard, because I was very, very, very close to the action, in the sense on the 10th of July, an airstrike came in and hit an IDP camp in Karen State, and it killed a number of people and injured about 26. Now, this airstrike performed by the Burmese military junta came in around about 1 a.m. and bombed this IDP camp, which has around about 3,000 to 4,000 people living in the area, which is right on the Thai border. There is a number of Thai military outposts that overlook the IDP camp, so they were also close to the action, but we had to take cover from the airstrikes. There was three bombs that were let go by the aircraft, and also strafing attacks. So they'd strafe first, and then they'll drop their ordnance. Now, in the next morning, we were able to get escorted in, and I was able to see the damage. I took video of that damage, of a number of houses, about four or five houses that got hit directly.
Right.
And a number of people were killed. And also a new NGO clinic that had just recently been built by an NGO. And also the school, the high school, they call it the college, that was also hit. So that was, I think, in the papers, in the Thai Nation newspaper, but I never saw anything that was seen in the Western press about this airstrike on an IDP camp, which to me is just dumbfounding, actually. I if that had happened in Kosovo or Bosnia back in the day, you know, it would have been world news. But
right,
nothing was reported.
There are issues in getting stories out of Myanmar for all the obvious reasons, i.e. it's more isolated, the NUG is quite divided, getting in there with any sort of from an official perspective is extremely
yes.
difficult. What did the IDPs, the internally displaced people, what did they have to say?
I spoke to a number of them through an interpreter, and they're scared. They're extremely scared. They just can't do anything about it. And the Karenni state and the Karenni army, the KA, doing the best they can with what they've got. I mean, they are one of the smallest ethnic groups in Burma and Myanmar.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got very little support or assistance from anyone. So it's a very, very unfair fight.
Well, it wasn't that long ago. We've been writing stories about Myanmar failed state. The UN has been coming out. I mean, we know the press releases get a tad dull because they often say the same, but they've been pretty harsh in terms of there cannot be any negotiations with the military junta because they won't negotiate. And it's kind of like, you know, when words fail, and I know I've asked you this before, but where do you think it needs to go next? In terms of logistical
higher,
help.
A much higher level.
Yeah.
Luke, I mean, ASEAN has tried with their five-point prospectus in trying to force the junta to come to the table and engaging with the NUG as a formative entity to talk and bring peace to the country, but it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I said before, this is not a organization that is under a government control. They are, as I said, a mafia. They are a rule to themselves, and they want what they want. And that will never change.
Right.
Now, recently, as you've seen, Aung San Suu Kyi has apparently, mm-hmm. been moved to house arrest. Now, what that means, who knows? We have no verification, no seen footage or video of where she's staying or what condition she's in. So, you know, words are very, they don't say much. It's the actions and evidence that we need to see of what is actually going on. But the powers that be in the West and ASEAN and so forth are not receiving anything. So we have to account for their actions, but we can't, because no one can see anything.
Ross, you there?
Yeah, mate. Yep.
Okay, that's better. Okay, that's better. Apologies for the interruption there. We just had to sort a couple of technical issues out. In regards to Aung San Suu Kyi, she's got a very mixed track record, in fact, atrocious when it comes to the Rohingya and the genocide. There is still a lot of goodwill towards her, despite what happened up in Arakan State well before the junta took over and ousted her. Do you believe she should remain as that titular head of the NUG?
No, absolutely no, Luke. I think she needs to move on. I think she could perform as a figurehead, maybe,
right.
as a person of interest for the country itself, but not as a leader. I think the NUG need to move her aside and place her in a position where she can advocate for the country and so forth, but not in leadership. I think her day is done. She, as you said, has a very unfortunate record when it comes to the Rohingya issue and so forth. So she's lost a lot of ground, I think, in the West, mm-hmm. and to the human rights side of things. But I think there needs to be a new generation come through. And I've seen that new generation. They're in their 40s and 50s. And even the leadership at the NUG level at the moment also need to move on. There's a number of ministers that I believe are still trapped in this old formative political sphere, which, you know, yeah. to the younger generation, they're not up to it. And I think that new generation that's coming through, the students that protested during the initiation of the coup back in February 2021,
yeah.
This has to bring about a new era in Burma and Myanmar politics. And I can see that in these young, formative assistant politicians that are within the NUG. And I see great fortitude mm-hmm. in their character, that want to see change and want to see a new Myanmar created in a federal union that is fair and fair dinkum
I understand.
Terminology.
Yeah. It's a bit of an issue around the region in that Southeast Asian countries, not just here, but there is a reluctance to groom younger leaders, to bring them up through the ranks. The exception being the Cambodian People's Party, where Hun Sen's standing aside, but again, it's for his son, and the cabinet ministers are standing aside also, again, for their son. So it's not like there's an independent effort to groom people based on merit. And we see the same in Thailand, Malaysia, they hang on forever. And then they complain. I remember talking to people within the Burmese opposition and in Cambodia as well, where their complaint would be, you know, we don't have anyone else. And it's like, well, it's your job to groom them.
Well, the nepotism is, as you say, Luke, is everywhere. I mean, I saw it in Kurdistan, in northern Iraq, when I was there for 7 years. And, you know, nepotism carries over into many cultures and political systems within Southeast Asia, etc. But I think there needs to be more grooming. There is an effort, I know, in northern Thailand by certain past diplomats from Switzerland and a number of other countries that are trying to groom leadership courses for both Thai and Burmese young students
right.
that are coming through. And, you know, there is a quiet effort. It's a very quiet one because both Thailand and, you know, Burma both have their issues. So it needs to be more effort. There needs to be more engagement through the UN, through NGOs, through, you know, state Western governments. They've all got to get in there and start to push for a much fairer and idyllic type of attitude towards politics in this region, because it's just going to continue to carry on unless there's that engagement at university levels and leadership levels and so forth.
Right. And is that being reflected among the IDPs as well? I mean, when you mention Aung San Suu Kyi to her, what's their reaction?
Well, as I said, the IDPs in you know, a lot of the ethnic states, whether it's Karenni State, Karen State, Shan State, Kachin State, Arakan State, they all have lost faith in a number of areas, both with the NUG and Aung San Suu Kyi, and with their NLD party that was disbanded by the junta. So there's a lot of discontent. There's a lot of non-interest in dealing. They just want to look after themselves and try to survive this part of history that is they are struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And they need, as I've said in the past, they need to band together. There has to become a new coalition of the willing, so to speak, and all these ethnic tribes need to get together, put aside their power struggles within, join forces, and bring the NUG to a point where they need to start to engage at a much more transparent and, you know, fair and faithful way of doing their political
right.
Their policies and bringing about some form of new alliance between the ethnic states.
Right. Now, this comes back to what's been talked up quite a bit lately, and that is the divisions within the NUG. Can you give us a bit of a rundown on what they are?
Well, the NUG took over from the NLD. They were put together by a number of politicians that were within the NLD. They came out, they went into the jungles, they crossed the border into Thailand after the coup because they were being tracked down and hunted. So they had to move quickly and establish themselves across the border in Thailand for a bit in areas like Mae Sot, Mae Hong Song.
Mm-hmm.
But they also started to have talks with the ethnics because they became a very quick ally in the sense that they felt that this was their chance to possibly bring about a new formative alliance against the junta.
Right.
So the NUG was created by a number of NLD politicians, and they were doing well. They were doing early on, they were putting together a democratic government. They brought in the Kachin ethnic group, who their leader is now the so-called prime minister. So they have a number of ethnic politicians within the NUG that mm-hmm. create this so-called national unity government. And to a certain point, they've done very well. But
yep.
on the other side of things, they have not brought in a true plan or strategy on how to do things to a point where it will counter the junta.
Right.
And there needs to be much, much more intelligent thinking from a planning and strategy from both a political and military
yep.
policy.
Right, because
you know, yep. they talk about. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, you're right.
But they talk about revolution, Luke, a lot. They term this revolution, but a revolution in anyone's doctrine must have a political and military solution that works side by side.
Mm-hmm.
They have to coincide with one another. And if they don't, their revolution will not work.
Right. So,
and we've seen in the past,
yep.
whether it's, you know, Che Guevara and Fidel Castro and their revolution, they're joined at the hip, both political and military. And this is what they don't understand and they need to put in place. Because if they don't do it and include the ethnics in a formative alliance, they're going to be living in the jungle or on the Thai side of the border for the next 50 years.
Right.
Now,
yeah.
It's a sad thing to say, but that's my opinion. And I've seen it firsthand, and I can see it from the ground up.
So we're talking about 135 different ethnic groups, and some of them are divided between Christianity and Buddhism, and we know the hardline Buddhists in Burma haven't exactly been kind over the years. Hang on. Towards the end of last year and earlier this year, it appeared that the NUG and the People's Defence Force, its armed wing, were making serious inroads. They had taken the fight to the military, particularly in the jungle, that was expanding into the villages and reaching the edges of provincial towns. Is that still the case?
Yes, it is. There's been a number of gains by the PDF, People's Defence Forces of the NUG, but it's sporadic, it's ad hoc. It's not planned, there's no strategy, there's no command and control. And this is another area where the NUG need to get a grip. They need to formalise all these PDFs into one specific command and control entity, and whether that's under the Ministry of Defence, under the NUG, etc. But there has been no effort, again, to put this into a formative and effective, you know, means of bringing a greater fight against the junta, because it's just too sporadic, it's too ad hoc, and there's no sort of formula to bring about a clear methodology of attack and defence or a strategy in which both the military and the political side can formulate a drive towards pushing back the junta away from the ethnic areas and ethnic states and back into, right into Mandalay, back into Yangon and Naypyidaw. And that's what needs to be done. There needs to be a combined effort. And that can't be done just by the NUG. It's got to be done by the Arakan, by the Kachin, the Chin, the Shan, the Kareni, the Karen, the Mon, etc.
Do you think it'd be worth setting up separate, like, divisions in that Arakan, where the Rohingya want their own state? And I'm hearing similar murmurings from Kareni. They're so far apart, they're divided by geography, traditions,
yes,
their own history. Is it really possible to get these different groups, given their geographical location, is it possible from a logistics perspective, and this is your sphere, that they can actually coordinate? Or would it be better to just balkanize Myanmar and have each individual grouping fighting for its own right to self-determination, which I know is what's been happening in years past, but perhaps it needs to be codified or formalised in a more military way?
That's a good question, Luke. I've thought long and hard about this scenario, but I truly believe they would be more better off staying within a federalised system, a federalised union, so to speak, a bit like the United States. Each state is independent, has autonomy, has the rules and regulations, etc., and obtain, just like, say, Iraq. Iraq is sort of divided, has the Kurdistan autonomous region, and they get a certain budget every year from the Iraqi government in Baghdad. Now, that sort of line of federalism could be brought and introduced into Burma, where you have, you know, an entity with it, whether it's in Naypyidaw or Yangon or where they want to have the capital.
Right.
But bringing everybody to the table before the revolution is completed. And this is where the NUG are failing politically. They need to show the ethnics some form of faith and prosperity for the future. And nothing is being written up. Nothing is being produced to show what is going to happen in the future. There has to be some form of new charter and policy put in place so that brings a bit of faith and a bit of optimism to the ethnic groups to say, oh yeah, well, this could possibly work.
Right.
Let's all sit down, go outside the country, let's get it formalised, let's put it into a proper charter, let's have a coalition of a national unity coalition where policy and things are talked about, and start to move towards something that's in writing, where everybody signs off on it and says, okay, this is what's going to happen once we finish our revolution and get rid of the junta. But nothing is done. And this is where the ethnics are not, they're not have that faith in the NUG.
As wars grind on, people do get fatigued, and I understand that the junta and Ong Myng Hlaing have engaged journalists from Syria and other like-minded places who are now doing their bidding, and they're on this renewed PR offensive to tell their side of the story, which I find difficult to sort of comprehend. But is that type of thinking, do you see any sort of swing at all towards the military in that ASEAN has failed, the five-point perspective, as you mentioned? Nobody, they might find it difficult dealing with the NUG, say in Washington or with the UN in terms of logistics, but do you think the military is making any moves in the right direction in terms of in terms of justifying what they've done on a PR level?
No, I don't. Look, I think they're losing ground, to tell you the truth.
Right.
And one indication of that is so-called releasing Aung San Suu Kyi into house arrest. Mm-hmm. Now, that may appease some people within the larger cities of, say, Mandalay, Yangon, etc. But from my contacts and my analysis of people, both within the PDF and their families that are living still in the cities and so forth, and what I'm getting back through information through Bangkok and Chiang Mai and others, that the people are still very much against the junta. Unfortunately, they have to stay very quiet because, they'll get a knock at the door, at 12 o'clock at night and get taken away. So there's still that difficult, ability to voice your opinion publicly, and people are still afraid. But generally speaking, there is a large amount of people that are still against the junta. Whether they'll bring in their so-called reporters from Syria and other like-minded countries, they can do all they like. But from this point on, I believe, NUG and the ethnics, to a point, could start to provide a little bit more of the psychological warfare that could be introduced from a media and social media perspective, that could force the junta even back further.
I remember I remember writing this type of commentary in a column about 4 or 5 months ago, and the NUG screamed at me. They weren't happy at all. But when I suggested that they could do more, and that, I mean, they've been good at running press conferences of late, they've been good at keeping people updated, they have their own forensic scientists, they have police, state police, that is, doing their own investigations, and they've done, as you're aware before, in regards to human trafficking, they've actually worked with Interpol and other such groups, but it's still not enough.
No, it's not, Luke. It's not enough. I mean, luckily they've got articles from the Irrawaddy, Myanmar Now, and a few other newspaper media.
Yeah, there's a bit of a trend. There's a trend.
Writing, daily reports on the airstrikes and so forth. So they've got that, but it's not world renowned, and it's not getting out into the world press on CNN and BBC and Al Jazeera, etc. Because they'll write up the headlines and say Aung San Suu Kyi, that she's been released from jail and put under house arrest again, but nothing that's being done on the ground, like this IDP camp airstrike. Yep. As I said, something of that nature, that's horrific. They're targeting women, children, you know, innocent people, innocent civilians, in strafing and bombing innocent civilians.
Right, and there is this...
This is a crime against... This is a horrendous crime against humanity.
There's a tribe of online publications up around Thailand's north that are reporting on these events, but they don't get a look in outside at all. It's
unfortunately not, Lou.
Groups like, say, the International Criminal Court, the ICC, and investigations and gathering evidence, independent evidence, which I know the NUG has done a very good job at collecting that, but surely these prosecutors and investigators also need to collect their own evidence.
Correct. That's a very good point, Luke. But again, it comes back to who actually brings the prosecution against the junta to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Now, is it NUG? Are they an entity that is being signed under the ICC charter and the ability to bring about a prosecution against the junta? Burma and Myanmar, I don't think, have signed that agreement with the ICC. So it's going to be difficult who is going to bring that charge or the prosecution against them. Now, if it was Australia, the United States, the EU, a country within the EU, then that might have some ground. But who is going to do it? That's the question. Who, and then who then starts the investigation on behalf of the person that brings, or the country that brings about those charges?
Perhaps Gambia again.
So there's a lot of questions and there's a lot of, you know, inability, I would say, to do this. And unfortunate as it is, there has to be, I mean, I think it was an African country that did bring about charges against the junta. So, I mean, we can speculate on bringing charges to the ICC against the junta. That would be wonderful if that could be done and started, and investigators starting to come out and gather evidence against them. That obviously would put a lot of pressure on the junta. But I don't, at the end of the day, Luke, I don't think they care, because they feel untouchable.
You mean the military?
The revolution. Yes, the military junta, the generals.
And that comes back to their relationship with Russia, which is blossoming. China is totally disinterested. And both of them have seats on the UN Security Council and can veto any moves in terms of acting against the junta.
No, that's correct. That's the truth of the matter. Politics at the highest level, you know, as you said, at the Security Council, where China and Russia both sit, it makes it difficult for anything to be passed or anything to be done. And this is where the ICC has some clout.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the NUG need to have that realisation that they can do more and they can bring about a whole new situation that would bring about the generals within the junta to account and bring them to account
right at
the highest level. Now, that's if they don't escape. If the revolution did move forward very quickly and effectively and they got into the cities and they did take control, I think these generals would be on the next plane to China or Russia, taking all their gold, their money and everything else with them and living the life of Riley.
It's not a particularly great note to sign off on, but Ross Milosevic, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Luke. Always a pleasure, and thank you very much to your listeners.
We'll talk again soon. This has been another podcast for The Diplomat. I am Luke Hunt, and I have been speaking to Ross Milosevic. Thank you.
Thanks, Luke. Bye for now.